Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we run the TechNet as we've done for the last 35 years, starting in 1982. This will be Technical Net number 1681 of the series that began way back in those dark ages, in those early days. N2SDJ and I tried to run a net, and it started off as 1 hour's worth, and it slowly got longer and longer because people were complaining there wasn't enough time to ask their questions and get the answers. The main purpose of the technical net, as you heard me say so often, is education. There are curious radio amateurs, both new amateurs and old ones. The old ones are, there are many different facets, little snippets of information of how wireless really works. Let me drop. Even a person who has 30 years of experience as a consultant for a large company can definitely learn a whole lot of new things about how wireless works, even though you did that work every day of the year. The way wireless is taught, the way radio is taught in our schools, could be improved an awful lot. It's set in its ways and its tradition that was started right after World War II. They set up a tradition and haven't changed it effectively enough, in my opinion, since then. The curious radio amateurs, if you really want to know somebody who understands radio, you got to hire a ham radio operator. That's true 90% of the time, so to speak. They're the people who have talked to other people about it, have developed a passion for the subject, have experimented with it, touched things with their own hands, transmitters, receivers, antennas, transmission lines, filters, antenna network analyzers, antenna tuners, and so on, vector network analyzers, spectrum analyzers, the guys who really touch the hardware and have a passion for it are the ham radio operators. They don't do it just as a 9-to-5 job, so to speak. Let me drop. For those kinds of people with that curiosity, gather here, as they have for the last 35 years, and share their information with each other. We teach each other how things go. The accuracy is not 100%, but we try. And it's kind of peer-reviewed because for the last 10 or 11 years, every single TechNet has been recorded, and they're available at a website called amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to amateurradio.tangovictor, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back every TechNet. People do that, and when we make mistakes, somebody brings it to our attention, and we bring it to your attention. So it's not 100% accuracy. One of the fun things I used to have with my fellow engineers at Airborne Instrument Laboratories, I would ask them some of the slightly tricky sounding questions with reference to radio equipment. And when they didn't get it 100% accurate, there's a certain kind of engineer who will laugh at himself and say, hey, this is a learning experience. There's a certain kind of engineer who thinks he can never be wrong. That's a person who's got a long way to go from my point of view. Let me drop. So we all have a batting average. Nobody has 100% batting average. We don't bat 1,000, as they say. We all have a certain error rate. You've got to admit that. And it doesn't matter whether you've got no degree, a bachelor, a master's, or a doctorate degree in the subject. You can still make mistakes, and there's still a lot to be learned. Inside of each radio amateur, every true radio amateur, from my point of view, is a scientist trying to get out. He wants to know how this stuff works. We had a discussion 2 weeks ago, I think it was, about the D-layer absorption. Absorption, reflection, refraction, deflection, destruction. That poor radio wave, that high noon going through the D-layer, really suffers. And what are the mechanisms of that suffering? There's a hydrometeor involved. It was Howie that brought to our attention that he sees a great big difference on a snowy day versus a non-snowy day as to what the D-layer is doing to his 80-meter signal, for instance. One of the sacred areas of radio is polarization. There are people who think that if an antenna emits a vertically polarized wave, that wave is going to be a purely polarized, matter where you look at it, no matter with what equipment. Good common sense assumption, assuming that the polarization is sacred. It is not. If our call K0GIO assigns it tonight, we're going to be discussing that subject among others. Let me drop. We have our chief scientist, Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who likes to discuss subjects with reference to physics and science. We get pretty deep into those sometimes. Also, Paul WS2N will tell us about the latest launch that took place with NASA and the other space agencies. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or comment by giving this group, when I ask for it, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need that. You need not sign in to let us know you're listening. After 35 years, we have good reason to believe that somebody is listening. Otherwise, this net under one leadership would not have lasted that long, 35 years. So we don't spend a whole lot of time with a great big long list of people who are listening. By way of listening, this net does connect by Echolink and IRLP, so we occasionally will hear very desirably people from other states out of the area and other countries, particularly Canada and Mexico, for instance, we've heard from. Someday we're going to be hearing a station from Europe, I believe. So, if you've got a question or comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RI, are you listening?
Did you
hear
Jay?
Okay. Kilo Zero, Gulf India, Oscar. First personal is call. Yes.
Eight K. Yep.
Okay, I heard call, Eric, in that order, and something like 8K. The whole prefix was chopped out. So squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then give us your full set of call letters and name. Go ahead. Okay, so far for sign-ins, we've got call and Eric. Is there anyone else who would like to sign into the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, from my point of view, we've got enough to get going. So, Carl, I got a very nice email from you, which I partially answered, telling you that we're going to discuss it. It's a very worthy subject. And no, you didn't get your answer in writing, which John KC2WGV used to spend an awful lot of time, and he would get as many as 75 technical reports, 75 emails, and he would try to answer them all. I'd much rather do it publicly here. So I'm pretty sure I know what your question is by way of what you've written to me. That is to say, without a doubt, the antenna coming out of this repeater, which is at the building in Glen Oaks, is a purely vertically polarized antenna. Let me drop. And if that antenna was in free space, no matter how you looked at it, the signal would be vertically polarized. One of the things that's not obvious, not well taught by any of the classes or any of the books, whenever you transmit a signal into a transmitting antenna and it gets radiated, that signal, after it gets radiated, touches everything in the environment, even insulators. Even the leaves on a tree are reflecting a significantly measurable amount of signal. So by the fact that every signal path between that transmitter and every receiving antenna that you've got, let's say a mile away, there's a million paths by which that signal is getting there. Simultaneously, it takes every one of those paths. And that's the good news. That means there's a zillion ways that that signal can find a method to get there. Occasionally, that gives you a disadvantage because all of those individual paths add up to a null. Occasionally, but that's rare. So I'll pass it over to you, Carl, to add a couple more words before we start discussing your subject, which is a good one. K0GIO, K2RIW. From Staten Island. Go ahead, Carl. Thank you.
interested. Thank you for answering my email. I appreciate it. It just fascinated me. You know, sitting here, and I had the antenna in a vertical position, and I heard nothing, zero. I pulled the antenna down into a fully horizontal position, and the repeater just blasted right in. Amazing how radio waves propagate and what can affect that propagation.
Yeah, out of curiosity, Carl was using an AOR receiver, wideband digital voice scanner receiver, AOR, model number AR-DV1. What he used almost doesn't matter. When I'm listening to this repeater in the morning, in the past, I used to have to set my handy talkie in my bathroom on a plastic shelf. I would have to set it horizontally to get good reception. Some time ago, the antenna got moved from one point on the building to another point on the building in Glen Oaks, this antenna that you're listening to, and that effect partially changed in my bathroom. Now, the strongest signal is at of a 45-degree angle, so to speak. This could be called the depolarization effect, but let me give you an example, and accept the fact that a radio wave is an electromagnetic wave, a light wave is an electromagnetic wave. They're both the exact same wave, just one is one of them is a million times higher in frequency. The light wave is roughly a million times higher in frequency. I mean, we all have a feeling for what 600 megacycles is like. Go a million times higher in frequency, and then you're in the middle of the optical band. So most of the effects that you see with light is pretty much the exact same effects you'll see with radio. So let me give you this example. Assume you and your friend are sitting down at a table. You're at opposite sides of the table and you're facing each other. Your wife comes along and takes her mirror and lays it on the table. So the mirror is laying on the table, flat, midway between you and your friend. You look directly with your eyes at your friend and you see your friend normally. You look in the mirror laying on the table and you see your friend, but in the mirror, your friend's image is upside down. You pick up the mirror and you hold it up at eye level, but now you sweep your arm off to the left. So the mirror is now way far off to the left, but at eye level in altitude, and you orient the mirror so that you can see your friend. You now see the reflection of your friend in the mirror, but he is reversed left to right. So when the mirror is on the table, your friend is upside down in the mirror image. When the mirror is over to the left at eye level, the image of your friend is reversed from left to right. Mirrors do this, and there's a whole lot of crazy puzzles that explain this phenomenon. Let me drop. But now if you put the mirror midway between those two positions, you're holding the mirror a little bit above table level, off to the left, so that midway between the position A and the position B that I described before, and you reorient the mirrors in such a way that you can see your friend. You'll see the reflection of your friend in the mirror, but your friend will be horizontal. The image will be horizontal when you're down at a 45-degree angle, so to speak, as far as the main path is concerned. People who design parabolic dish antennas recognize this effect. They call it the depolarization effect. You put a feed horn in front of a parabolic dish antenna. As far as focusing is concerned, all the signal when you're receiving that hits the parabolic dish, angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, and all the signals reflecting off that parabolic dish go into the feed horn, and so everything is focused. But there's a catch, my job.
Is this radio working?
This radio is working beautifully. Wonder why you ask that right now.
And I'm trying to check in on the other frequency and you're not letting me get in, or there's something wrong with the receiving system. That's why.
I'm pretty sure that Eric, I'm going to go over to Eric for a minute. I believe Eric has recently recognized a failure of some of the equipment up at Glen Oaks. So maybe I'm going to take a look right now. Okay, I'm hearing the signal. We are being repeated to the 975-375 repeater, but maybe only in one direction. Let's see if Eric's got an explanation of all of this. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the repeater can't hear me on 8-5. You not hear me at all. I tried several times to put my call in to check in for a question, and you're talking over me or something.
Eric's going to explain all that. Come in here, Eric.
Yeah, the remote receiver that he usually gets into is down. Andy went and fixed it for me last week, or was it the week before, and it failed, so it's not Andy's fault. Maybe the amplifier that I gave him failed and liked the cold weather. Maybe the receiver failed, or maybe the antenna got disconnected. You pick. Somebody has to go up there and have a look. And by the way, Dick, I sent you an email with a picture of Channel 47, Channel 4's brand new transmitter on the top of the World Trade Center, and it's 100 kilowatts, and it's made by Rode and Schwartz.
Rode and Schwartz, real good company. You sent me a real good picture. I recognized 7 times 12, 84 individual modules on the right-hand side of that picture, and 7 major vertical cabinets on the left-hand side. So are there 84 individual solid-state modules that make up that 100-kilowatt transmitter? And I think you're saying this is the one that's at the World Trade Center, the new Freedom Tower. Give me a couple of words on that, Eric. KE2J, K2IW.
K2RW, K2J. The stuff on the right, with all the drawers in it, actually, let me put the picture up. Those tall cabinets don't have any transmitting gear, and it's actually all, it's all IT stuff. It's all Ethernet stuff. It's all networking stuff. We don't use video anymore, remember? But yeah. I don't know, because they're UHF, I don't know what those drawers put out, but I know that we've got a small one, same gear. Actually, I'm going to finish it up Monday. Incidentally, I don't know if you noticed, but Channel 31, which is WPXN, they went on at midnight Friday morning.
Channel 31. Now, are you speaking of Channel 31 as far as its advertised channel number, or is that this real RF channel number, Eric? Go ahead.
The advertised channel number, I don't remember what they are. I think they're on 30.
Joe is the guy who keeps track of that, and Joe's signal sounds really good. Let me finish the statements that I started now with Carl. So, in the case of a parabolic dish, all the signal hitting the dish gets properly reflected at just the right angle, at just the right distance, and it all gets focused at the feed horn. So you think that the dish should have 100% efficiency. A parabolic dish antenna typically has more numbers like 60 or 65% efficiency for a number of reasons. The illumination taper, if the feed horn was designed in such a way that it fed the signal equally to every square inch of the dish, you'd have the capability of making 100% efficiency. But if you drew a X across the dish, the 45-degree diagonals from the dish have this depolarization effect that I just described to you. When you hold that mirror on the table to the left of you and halfway between the two, and you see the reflection of your friend horizontal in the mirror image, that's called the depolarization effect. And the diagonal corners of a parabolic dish, if it's a deep dish, has a depolarization effect. Some of that signal reflecting off the dish. Even though the signal may have started off purely horizontal, as it reflects off the dish, it's not purely horizontal when it comes to the focal point where the feed horn is located. So, there's a whole bunch of different phenomena going on here, recall. Let me drop. Every signal you've ever transmitted is reflecting off 1 million objects or more in the environment before it goes from point A to point B. We all think that just that main signal, the line of sight signal, is the important one. In many cases, there's a darn many other signals. Now, a handy talkie is a beautiful voltage probing device. Choose a relatively weak repeater or a relatively weak signal on, say, 2 meters, and in your living room, so to speak, you translate the handy talkie in X, Y, and Z. You move it out and in, left and right, up and down. That's the X, Y, Z translation. You can also rotate it about X axis, about the Y axis, about the Z axis. So you're testing horizontal, vertical, and whatever. You will find out that while receiving, there are many places in your room where the strongest signal is some crazy polarization at some crazy location. You're looking at the phenomena called multipath. That signal's reflecting off the file cabinet, the house wiring, the gutters, the downspouts, the grass in the front yard, the antenna that's on the chimney. That signal that gets to your handy-talkie is getting there by a zillion paths. And every one of those individual paths is a voltage-bearing signal. You take all of those millions of paths, take each of those individual voltages with their appropriate amplitude and their appropriate phase angle when they reach your rubber duck antenna on your handy-talkie, and add them all up in a vector manner. In other words, you add them up paying attention of the voltage amplitude and the phase angle of polarization, and the voltage phase angle of whether or not the signal is early or late, and that kind of phase angle. You add them all up in a vector manner, and that's what the rubber duck or the whip antenna on your scanner, your AOR scanner, is finally seeing.
Repeater.
If you pick up your AOR receiver recall, translate it to some other room of the house or some other floor of the house and repeat the experiment. You'll see that it changes. Polarization is nowhere near as sacred as you think. And with the right kind of compound polar reflection, you can end up with any polarization in the world, including circular polarization. The signal coming out of the antenna at Glen Oaks is a purely vertical polarized signal, linearly polarized. Some of those places where you could receive that signal, where some of it's reflecting off a horizontal object, some of it's reflecting off a vertical object, and they're being combined with a certain time delay difference between the two, your rubber duck, your whip antenna, under some circumstances, might be actually seeing a circular polarized antenna. This is a circular polarized signal. It's like the clockwise in one location and counterclockwise in another. So polarization is complicated, and polarity of signal, polarization, is not sacred. Isn't that crazy, Carl? K0GIO, K2RIW. You got a call.
K2RIW, K0GIO. I have experimented not moving the AOR scanner, but moving my 2-meter 440 handheld around the house. In my living room, if I put the 2-meter handheld flat onto the floor, under the coffee table, I get best reception. In my bedroom, it's got to be straight vertical. It is truly an amazing thing.
You're proving it. And now, one step beyond that, which is really crazy, even though the two signals that you transmit and receive on 2 meters when you're talking to a repeater, in this case of this repeater, the two signals, transmit versus receive, are 600 kc apart. That's 0.6 megacycles out of 146 megacycles. That's a very small percentage of difference in frequency. And so therefore you think, however the signal behaves on 146.85, it'll behave the same way on 146.25. Not at all. Between you and that repeater, which is, and from Staten Island, I'm going to guess it's 25 miles away, I'm going to guess there's a half a million wavelengths. By the time that signal goes half a million wavelengths, so we can calculate that one exactly, that a couple of percent difference in frequency makes a big difference. The bottom line of that is that you move your handy-talkie back and forth, up and down, until you get the strongest signal when you're receiving. That is not necessarily the position and orientation that will give you the strongest signal on transmitting. You'd be amazed how many times somebody is in the fringe area with a handy-talkie on this repeater. He moves it around, he's getting a nice, strong signal on receive. He tries to transmit back to us, and we almost can't hear him. He's got to find another location where the signal is going to be strongest at the transmitting frequency over that half a million wavelengths of distance. Ain't that crazy, Carl? K0GIO, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K0GIO. Correct. I've noticed with my handheld, transmitting from my living room, impossible. I can't get to repeaters that are on Staten Island. in order to actually transmit and get to a feeder on Staten Island, I have to move to my kitchen. So, yes, it is a crazy phenomenon.
You'll be amazed now the secretness of the information you and I are now discussing, Carl. I graduated with 28 electrical engineering students in the electrical engineering department under Harun Marus, was the name of the guy who headed the engineering department at Pratt Institute. And of those 28 guys, one of the things that was important to me is, could they repair the radio, the tube radio in those days, in their room? After questioning those 28 guys, or most of them, I came to the conclusion about four of those guys could probably repair the radio in their room. These are guys with a bachelor degree in electrical engineering, coming out of a good school, after a real good set of lab courses taught by Professor Boyette. And so we were touching radio equipment. Because I had worked my way through that college by earning the money by fixing radios and televisions in my hometown in Middle Island, Long Island, whether or not a person with an engineering degree could fix the radio in his room, not even the more complicated thing called television, just a simple radio. If you had a blown out 120 microfarad, 120 volt filter capacitor, would they be able to fix that? I came to the conclusion two or three of those guys, of the 28 electrical engineers, would be able to do that. It tells me something about the practicality of the way electrical engineering is taught. Right now, the things that you and I are discussing, real propagation, real multipath, real polarization effects, real frequency effects, and whatever, the average electrical engineering student with a bachelor degree and probably a master's degree coming out of school right now would not understand that information. We amateur radio operators who touch it, feel it, care about it, have the passion for it, there are times when we know more than the people with all kinds of fancy degrees. Back to you. That's
repeater, time out.
What you just heard is an opinion. So back to you for any final comments, Carl. And the only mistake you made is to think that your question wasn't important enough to be worthy for the question for the TechNet. I hope you're going to come back with more of these unworthy questions. That's a joke. K0GIO, K2RIW, go ahead, Carl.
Late check-in.
Late check-in recognized, but call first. Go ahead, Carl.
K2RIW, K0GIO. I'm happy with the answer. I having been involved in shortwave radio for many years and dealing with propagation and so many different scenarios with that stuff, it's mind-boggling the stories that I could go through with that. I'm happy with the answer and the discussion, and many thanks. It's just very, very informational listening to you every week.
Hey, Dr. Roy, we got a happy customer there. We're gonna have to send him a bill. That's a joke. And even on this subject, you're allowed to come back and ask more because there's a lot more to it. A lot of individual details. Who's the person who said late check-in? And do you want us to put you on the list because you've got a question? Give me your caller as a name right now. K2RIW.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. And here's Joe, and yes? Yeah, Dick, you could put me last on the list.
Okay, we got you for a late check-in. Now we're going to go over to Eric, KE2EJ, who's going to wait for the beep. Go right ahead, Eric, K2RIW.
You can put me on the questions list for next week. Maybe I didn't make this week.
You're on the list for this week, Joe. Right after Eric, we're going to go to you and then go to QIW in that order. So hang in there, Joe. By the way, before your signal was nice and loud, now it's a little bit noisier. Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, I basically wanted you to open the email. I'll have a look at that picture. By the way, of those blue racks, the first one on the left, the part on the top of it, that's the exciter. That's all the stuff that makes the little bit of RF that feeds the rest of that stuff. And I have a bunch more pictures. The broadcast floor is completely filled with that stuff. And actually, I didn't get a chance to take pictures of it, but I will next time. The combiner and mass filter system for all the different stations is a phenomenal piece of engineering. It's an amazing looking machine. The Urus, they have an interesting way of combining and also doing the mass filters. To do the mass gauges, they convert from waveguide back to coax, and to do the mixing, they do it in waveguide. It's quite an interesting, massive looking device. I just kind of wanted to throw you in and tell you that 13 picked up another zombie channel, so you now have 13-4. And PXN, which is Ion TV, they went on the air. And let's see, CBS is just about ready. Let me let it drop. CBS is the lone proprietor of an American-made transmitter. They bought a gate there. The Rhodes and Schwartz, everybody else bought the Rhodes and Schwartz. They all look the same. Actually, my transmitter is only one rack with three amplifier cards in it. The gate there is water cooled just like the rest of these guys is, except that they use off the shelf power supply, so they have fans. So their transmitter makes some noise, whereas all the rotors are so quiet you can't even tell whether on K2RW, K2J.
When it comes to high power RF, and almost all the high power RF that I've worked on, when it comes to military transmitters on Air Force airplanes like the B-1B bomber, I worked on that program for about 25 years, and the EA-6B standoff jammer, Navy jammer, each of these very high power transmitters, a high percentage of them, were traveling wave tubes in the kilowatt and multi-kilowatt region. In the case of traveling wave tubes, high power traveling wave tubes, they usually are set up in such a way that the drive power requirement for the traveling wave tube, TWT, is somewhere between 0 dBm and plus 10 dBm. In other words, very close to a milliwatt or 10 milliwatts is the usual drive requirement to get full power out. A 100 kilowatt transmitter is plus 80 dBm. In other words, 80 dB louder than a milliwatt. And dBm is a very frequently used amplitude component, amplitude measuring parameter used by a lot of radio or wireless or particularly military people. Let me drop. If you take all the signals that you're rating, that you receive, and you rate them in dBm, which is a logarithmic scale, and you add the pluses and minuses for all the stages of gain and loss, the loss of your cable might be 3 dB, the gain of your antenna might be 10 dB, and so on. And you take the dBm of signal strength and add and subtract those numbers, it becomes nice and easy to figure out real fast what's happening. And when you're troubleshooting and tapping into the system at various places, how strong should the signal be there if everything is working normally? A more logical technique would be, hey, how strong is the signal in microvolts? And how many times is the gain of that stage? Well, you try to do things in microvolts and times, gain, and you start ending up with multiplying by half a million and dividing by half a billion, and the mathematics becomes very unwieldy. Whereas when you convert everything to decibel scale, which is logarithmic, simply adding and subtracting relatively small numbers allows you to see what's happening real fast. So here's my question, Eric. That Rhodes and Schwartz 100 kilowatt transmitter, what's the approximate drive power requirement for that thing to do its job? Do you guys in the broadcast industry also set a standard of around 0 to plus 10 dBm is the usual drive level for a transmitter? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. It depends on the manufacturer. Like mine transmitter puts out 0 dBm, and then there's a little brighter stage that brings it up to something like 1 watt. And then that goes into a bunch of power dividers to feed each amplifier. Same sort of deal here. They have one one, actually, in that big transmitter, I think there's four of them. The drivers that feed the individual amplifiers. The amplifiers themselves, I think, take plus 10. The total output of 80 dBm, which is one heck of a lot of watts.
Yeah, just to put things in perspective, the biggest burn you've got on the electric range in your kitchen is somewhere around 5,000 watts. The heater inside your electric dryer, your clothes dryer, is also something around 3 or 5,000 watts. 100,000 watts of RF energy coming out of that broadcast transmitter that you showed me the picture of. That's at World Trade Center. That's all a lot of steam. You got to really make sure that the transmission line that signal is going through is going to be low in loss, like a couple of tenths of a dB per 100 foot, or otherwise it's going to get awfully hot to the touch, conducting all that power.
6 inch coax.
And 6 inch coax probably has a very small number of dB per 100 feet of insertion loss. It's probably also either dry nitrogen filled, because it's an air line, or it is filled with sulfur hexafluoride to make sure it doesn't arc over. There's a desiccating device to make sure that all of the gases that are pressurizing that cable are real dry gases. Is all of that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, interestingly enough, they have a nitrogen generator. It's quite noisy, quite pure. Actually, when they shut it out, there's a cryo container with liquid nitrogen. Actually, it's all low pressure stuff. Let's see. Who was it? I think it was CBS that actually bought, for what some strange reason, they bought 8-inch coax. You can see it, it's not finished yet. You can see it up on the ceiling. It's kind of absurd. But that's what they did. The nitrogen system is quite interesting. It doesn't do it with a cryo cooler. It's from a company called N2. It's an interesting way they separate the nitrogen from the air. And it's real pure. And that's what we use for the whole system, all the way up to the gas stop at the antenna cell. My system is independent from the V's are independent from the U. And I'm not sure, I have to look, whether or not the mast combiner is actually pressurized. I'm not sure it is, but that'd be interesting to look at. I know that my 60 kilowatt transmitter, all my waveguide was just, whatever the air pressure was, period, nothing special.
I've got a handheld computer in my hand, and if I can find the right spot where I put that darn program, I've got a program where you tell me the diameter of the coax cable, and I can tell you the cutoff frequencies. And I can't find that formula right now. But 8-inch diameter cable, isn't that getting close to the cutoff frequency for some of the upper UHF channels? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, we don't worry about that anymore. Our upper UHF channels are 37 and below. So it's not that bad. Yeah, I think the cutoff frequency is around a gig in that neighborhood. I can look it up. It'll take me a second if you really want to know.
Let me think now. 1,000 megahertz. 30 centimeters. 30 centimeters is a wavelength. 2.54 is the number of centimeters per inch. And 8 inches. Three centimeters. So it's getting close. Getting very close to the cutoff. And the cutoff for a rectangular waveguide is easy to calculate it. If the major dimension of the guide is more than a half wavelength at the upper frequencies, at the next level of frequencies, you could propagate that down the guide. We'll get back to that. Just to give you guys a couple of easy numbers to remember, let me drop. 1 of the most frequently used units for measuring signal strength when it comes to what's happening at the antenna, what's happening at the receiver front end, what's happening at the IF strip, what's happening at the final detector, how strong is the signal in the air, and so on. To measure signals with reference to 1 milliwatt and to express it logarithmically, it's called dBm, decibels with reference to a milliwatt, dBm, delta, bravo, mic, small delta, large bravo, small mic. No, lowercase, uppercase, lowercase is the way it's usually abbreviated. So 0 dBm is 1 milliwatt. A tenth of a milliwatt is minus 10 dBm, because the log of 0.1 happens to be minus 1. And to convert things into logarithms, you multiply it by 10 after taking a log to convert them into decibels. So a tenth of a milliwatt is minus 10 dBm. 10 milliwatts is plus 10 dBm. If you took a milliwatt and multiply it by 1,000, you've got a watt. The log of 1,000 is 3 to the base 10. Multiplied by 10 is 30. Therefore, a 1-watt signal, 1,000 times more than 1 milliwatt, is plus 30 dBm. 10-watt signal is plus 40 dBm. 100-watt signal is plus 50 dBm. A kilowatt signal is plus 60 dBm. 100 kilowatts is the plus 20 because of the 100, and the plus 60 because of the kilowatt, and now 100 kilowatts is plus 80 dBm, 60 plus 20. So the first time you hear all this jazz, of course it's a bit confusing, but it's a darn good thing to learn if you're ever going to be in the business. Let me drop. If you're going to be in the business where you have to keep track of signal strengths, so anything that's divisible by 10, or 100, or 1,000, or 10,000, or 100,000. It's very easy to figure out the ratio. 10,000 is something with four zeros. The log to the base 10 of 10,000 is 4. Multiplied by 10 is 40. So 10,000 is 40 decibels different. If it's 10,000 times stronger, it's plus 40 dB stronger. If it's 10,000 weaker, it's minus 40 dB stronger, so to speak. So, and the crazy thing about decibels is that 0 dBm, zero signal in decibel scale, is not zero signal strength. The log of zero is one, if you know what I mean. So, do I have that right? No, the log of one is zero. The log of zero is minus infinity. So, the logarithmic scale, zero in the logarithmic scale is not zero signal strength. You'd be amazed how many times people get that confused. Now, the guy who had a question, who had a little trouble signing in because of some of the equipment failure here on the repeater system, was Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y. Go right ahead, Joe. W-H-O-L-Y-Y, one of our frequent sign-ins who sometimes challenges the living daylights out of us. K-2-R-I-W, you got it, Joe. Go easy with us tonight. Hello, Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y. I found the program. Okay, I'm going to put in 8. And sure enough. So, the cutoff frequencies, the first cutoff frequencies for round waveguide is in gigahertz, 0.86 for the TE11 mode, 1.13 gigahertz, 0.86 gigahertz, 1.13 gigahertz, and so on. So 860 megs is the highest frequency where you're not going to be multimoding on that cable. And that's way beyond the channel 84. Used to be 860 megs, as I remember. So no problem. We're not going up to channel 84 with the UHF channels anymore. So 8-inch diameter cable, good stuff. I can see that, Eric. One more call for Joe, and then I'm going to go over to Joe number 2, QYW. W-H-O-L-Y-Y, H-O-L-Y-W. Go ahead, Joe.
This is the IRL feed, Joe.
And WS2N, trying to check in, try before Dick for the space report later.
Okay, we're hearing you very well right now, by whatever means you're using it. Looks like Joe RYY, Joe number one, is not ready right now, even though he was sounding beautiful before. Joe number two, KC2, QYW. Go right ahead, Joe number two, K2RIW listening.
Hey, what's up, guys? Yeah, I'm doing my Facebook Live on my HT walkie-talkie. Yeah, Dick, my question to you is, are you guys going to be on next week? That's my question.
What I think you're saying is that next week, is that Christmas Eve, Christmas Day? Let me think now. I think that's going to be Christmas Eve. Is that true, Joe? And are we going to be on Christmas Eve? It's an interesting question. I'm going to probe the other two guys and let them decide. I'll go with whatever they say. So, let's find out right now. Do you think we should have TechNet next week, Roy? AC2, Golf Sierra, K2RIW.
I'm fine with it. You know, I just had my latkes, so I'm not impacted. It's up to you and Paul.
Okay, WS2N. Ready for your vote, Paul, as to whether or not we should, or should we take the week off because it's a holiday, or should we go plowing right through? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I can't guarantee next week, but definitely New Year's Eve, no problem. I'll combine New Year's Eve with straight key night. But I should be here next week, but no guarantees. Back to you, sir.
Okay, if I understand you correctly, New Year's Eve, you say you're definitely available, but Christmas, but I think you said New Year's Eve, you're definitely available, but Christmas, but Christmas Eve, you might not be available. Is that what you said, Paul? Run that by again.
QSL, that's right, yes. No problem on New Year's Eve. Like I said, that's straight key night. I always have to make at least one contact for straight key night. But, of course, that could be done the next day, too. That runs for 24 hours. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, where there's some doubt, and where we've had essentially no vacations for multiple years. I think the TechNet was only off one time in the last 10 years, one weekend. Maybe we should declare a vacation next week. So very glad Joe number two asked the question. Let's say that we will not have a TechNet next week. So we're gonna take a vacation for the first time in quite a few years. KC2QIW, you're allowed to ask any other question you want, Joe. K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it sounds good to me. Yeah, the reason why I asked is because, you know, I'm off for the whole week. Yeah, so I can stay up late. But, you know, I'll go on HF, you know. And, yeah, thank you.
KD2MZ for a quick question for Eric.
This is CJC, check in.
Mike, you've got it. Go ahead.
Thank you, Nick. Eric, I got a quick question for you. I just did a quick rescan of my TV a few minutes ago. I do that every so often. Channel 41 and 42 are no longer scanning. Are they off the air? Only 43 and 44 come in.
No, if you have been watching 41 and 42, they have been announcing that you need to rescan your receiver, otherwise you won't pick them up anymore. As of now, yes, there's no more 41 and 42. Although, after a bit of time, I suspect they'll turn it back into 41 and 42. But in the meantime, it's 43 and 44. You'll get them there, which is from that 100 kilowatt transmitter we were talking about.
Okay, Eric, thanks. You answered my question. Thank you very much. Back to Nick.
Okay, the person who signed in with blank 2GJC, please give me your full call. And and your name, and go right ahead with your question. K2RIW and TechNet. My name is Dick. I'm pretty sure I heard a GJC. Okay, maybe not. We've gone down the list of everybody who signed in. I think it's time we go over to the science and physics portion of the program. And what subject have you selected tonight, Roy? AC2, Golf Sierra, K2RIW. You got it, Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. I think the topic will be, I have a short presentation about black holes, but before we begin that, I just want to remind everyone that the email address for the mailbag is mailbag@limarktech.net. Again, mailbag@limarktech.net. Also, I want to bring up, Dick, that you're in good company because Nobel Prize winner Richard Feynman fixed radios for a lot of years when he went to school as well. He was never a ham, unfortunately, but he did the same things that you did.
Yeah, at the time, since I was working my way through college, and it took me 6 years, by the way, on and off, drop out a year and earn enough money to go back. And I had to go to the basement and dig into the boxes to get my records because I never thought I was coming back. Are you also going to be mentioning tonight how people can get to this nice website you are describing to me in a website called The History of Wireless Everything? AC2GS, K2RIW, good, Roy.
Yes, I have a lot of links that I've set up, alias links. They all end in limarktech.net. The only thing that's different is the first word separated by a dot. So, in other words, if you're interested, there's a very nice summary article on wireless technology for the last odd century that can be found by typing in wireless.limarktech.net. And as I go through other topics, I will point you to websites that have the similar type of thing, where it's a unique first word separated by a period, and the rest is limarktech.net. Let me drop.
And looking forward to black holes, I think I told you that Stony Brook had standing room only in a room that normally holds 300 people when they had the subject of black holes on the astronomy open night a couple of years ago. You got it right.
Yes, I actually wrote up a little two-page thing which I'll try and recite, and then we'll talk about the new discovery. Before I get to that, though, if you don't mind, I think flat mirrors are wonderful topics for just discussion and understanding difficult concepts. You mentioned that mirrors reverse left to right, but of course, flat mirrors don't actually reverse left to right, because if you turn horizontally and look in the mirror, the left side of the image and the right side of the image haven't shifted. So the point that I'm trying to get at is mirrors are interesting because they don't really reverse top to bottom or left to right. What they really do is they reverse front to back. So that's a little bit unique, and we don't kind of think about that when we're looking in a mirror. But if you think about it, it's like the image has taken you, rotated you so that your front is reversed and your back is reversed, and that's the image that flat mirrors do. So that's my little observation on flat mirrors for tonight.
Yeah, Feynman also would explain it that way. However, when the mirror is halfway between on the table, flat in front of you, versus being held at eye level off to your left-hand side, and halfway between those two, where the image you see now is horizontal, the person you see in that mirror will be horizontal when you hold that mirror in that funny place. It's a depolarization effect. It's not so easy to explain that one as saying you're looking at the back versus the front. In that particular image that you see, the person truly is horizontal, even though the real person is vertical. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Okay, I'll have to look that up and think about that and see what I can come up with. I have a interesting little puzzle. You know, we usually get to these discussions about room air and such. So let me throw out a little puzzle before I get to black holes for the audience, see if anyone's interested in it. If you have, say, a helium balloon on a string tied to the rear of your inside of your car, and you're driving the car, and the balloon is floating in air at the level of your head. Does the balloon move in any particular direction when you gun the accelerator? Does it move in any direction when you hit the brakes too fast? Maybe you want to throw it out to the audience and see if we can trick them.
And that particular puzzle, you've got to make sure that you make it clear that the balloon is tied to the back of the car. You really mean it's tied to the back of a seat inside the car. It's inside the windows are all rolled up. The balloon is tied to something, like maybe the shift lever on the floor. And so the balloon is normally straight up, the helium-filled balloon. And now you're accelerating by gunning the car or turning the brakes, or you're on a clover wreath making a turn. In any of those cases where there's a definite acceleration, what will the balloon do is what I think the question is. Is that true, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes, that is the gist of it. It's attached inside the car compartment. It's in the rear of the compartment where the passengers sit. You're in the driver's seat looking at the rearview mirror as you gun the engine and hit the brakes.
Okay, we're now probing for volunteers as to what is that balloon going to do.
Of the vehicle.
I think the person asked how old is the vehicle. That's not a factor. Assuming it's an airtight, almost airtight passenger compartment and the windows are rolled up. So now you've got this volume of air moving along with the car, and you're accelerating the car by either gunning it, turning on the brakes, or making a hard right-hand turn on the clover leaf. What's the balloon going to do? Do we have any volunteers? Please give me a call. It is right now.
Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee.
This is Jason.
Okay, Michael Yankee first. Go right ahead. What's your proposal?
It's not going to go nowhere. It stays put.
Okay, Michael Yankee says. What's your name, by the way, Michael Yankee?
Oh, it's Gene. It's Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee. Gene from Brooklyn.
Okay, Gene. Gene says no change. Mr. Golf, Juliet, Charlie, GJC. What do you think the balloon's going to do?
I think it's going to stay erect following the vehicle. Call is W2, Whiskey 2, Tango, Juliet, Tango, W2, TJP, Tom, Brooklyn.
The US 2-1.
Very fine, Tom. Now we got you. And Paul's going to make a proposal. So we've got two, no changes. The balloon just stays right straight up as we do all these things to the automobile, the helium-filled balloon. Paul, WS2N, you got it.
What are they saying, politics now? I have to recuse myself because I know Dick has had very similar things. It had me 20 or more years ago on the TechNet, so... Unfortunately, I know the answer. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Very, very fair of you to recuse yourself, Paul. We'll gather at least one or two more. Anybody else is going to tell us what is the balloon going to do? In Roy's example, it's a helium-filled balloon on a string tied to the floor, so to speak, in the back seat of the car. The balloon is normally straight up, and now the car is going to be accelerating because you're gunning it, decelerating because you're applying the brakes, or it's making a hard right-hand turn in a clover leaf. So we've had two No changes so far. Anybody else got any other suggestions? Give me your call letters right now.
And it's Leo, Dick. I know the answer.